This is The Guardian.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, coming to you from Gadigal land. And this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week. Running a country is all about ideas. Ideas on how to manage the economy, how to deal with the climate crisis, how to put a roof over people's heads. So what does Labor's win at the Dunkley by-election tell us about the Coalition's ideas on how Australia should be governed? Today, I'm talking to Head of Newsroom Mike Tisha and National News Editor Patrick Keneally about the Coalition's policy deficit. It's Friday, the 8th of March.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher-education. This message was paid for by EY.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Gabs.
Good morning, Patrick.
Morning, Gabs.
So last week we talked about how we couldn't read too much into this by-election result, Mike, but nevertheless, people seem to be doing just
Let's do it this week.
So why don't we join them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we did say you shouldn't read too much into one by-election result, which is true, but also that perhaps this one is slightly more of a pointer than some others because it represented the kind of seat that the Coalition seems to be aiming at the next federal election, an outer suburban seat, focusing on cost of living issues. This should be the moment for the Liberal Party to make a big gain, and that did not happen. I think it is legitimate to read some things into that, and particularly I think it's a sort of momentum thing. At the end of last year, after the Voice referendum, felt like the government were really in the doldrums, had lost the initiative on a lot of things. But then in the new year, they had the decision on the stage three tax cuts. Now they've solidified that, I think, by holding on to this seat, which I think is actually a much better result for Labor than just the status quo. And it feels like suddenly it's the Coalition who are on the back foot in terms of defining the policies that they think are going to win over those voters.
There's a lot to get into in that, but Patrick, what did the numbers of the night tell us?
So the Liberals did have an improvement in their primary vote. It was up by 6.6% and their primary vote was at 39%. But Labor didn't actually lose a vote in their overall primary vote. The two-party preferred vote was up for the Liberals as well by 3.5%. But there's a few things that you have to take into account when you look at those results. One is that One Nation didn't run a candidate. You know, Palmer's United Party didn't run a candidate as they did at the federal election. So a lot of those voters came back to the Liberal, particularly in the northern suburbs of Dunkley, which are a bit more conservative. So we just didn't see the kind of swings that would be needed to form government.
But they didn't take votes off Labor.
Yeah, so those votes essentially didn't come from winning votes from Labor. Labor's primary vote also went up slightly. Greens did quite poorly. So I think the basic takeaway is the Liberals, in this case at least, did not win votes from Labor, and that's the key point. That's what they will have to do if they want to win government.
Patrick, they have announced a reshuffle of the cabinet this week in response. What does that reshuffle tell us about what their priorities are going to be now?
Well, we knew that there was going to be a Liberal frontbench reshuffle coming for a while. They were kind of holding off until after Dunkley. But they did make probably more changes than we were expecting. They've appointed Luke Howarth as the Shadow Assistant Treasurer and spokesperson for financial services. He's a fellow Queenslander, pretty strong performer. Melissa McIntosh has also been put into the Shadow Ministry. She's a spokesperson for energy affordability, and that kind of signals a really key point of attack. You know, before the election, Labor promised that power bills would be hundreds of dollars lower. That hasn't eventuated for a number of reasons, including obviously, you know, energy prices going up globally. But they see that as a key way to attack the government. They've, you know, put forward this policy of small modular nuclear reactors. We've got also Senator Andrew Bragg has been promoted to opposition spokesperson on housing. You know, housing was a bit of a blind spot, I think, in the by-election in Dunkley. The Greens have been really active on housing policy. And I think it was James Fasola made the point that, you know, they seem like the opposition party now on housing rather than the actual Liberals. But look, in the fallout of it, you had people like Tony Barry, a Liberal strategist, saying, we really need to do more on housing. We should be the party of home ownership. They really, at the moment, they're still trying to figure out what their policy should be. You know, Andrew Bragg's talked for a long time about how people should have access to their super. Seems like, you know, there's obvious flaws with that. If you just inject a whole lot more money into the housing market, it's pretty obvious what will happen.
Prices will go up.
You don't have to be a, you know, university-trained economist to work that out. But, you know, they'll have to come up with some other affordability policies to really take to the government.
I think the difficulty for the coalition, perhaps we focus on two areas, one housing and also energy, is that they can't go on for much longer without putting some meat on the bones of their policy. So far, it's been pretty scant. Obviously, they've been talking a lot about nuclear in the energy front, which we can perhaps talk about a little bit more. But on housing, they're really stuck in a difficult place, I think, because, as Patrick said, it's the Greens who've been making all the running in opposition to Labor on housing, but they are coming from a point of view of doing things for renters, building a lot of public housing, investing public money, but, you know, the government actually becoming a property developer, and that kind of stuff is completely anathema to the coalition. They're definitely not going to get involved in anything like that.
But ironically, it was the coalition under Menzies who built a lot of the public housing stock that exists today.
It was, but ironically, the Greens are now arguing in favour of a Menzies policy. But Peter Dutton is not going to go anywhere near that. And as Patrick mentioned, like this idea that people accessing their super to get more money to buy their first home is just another one in this whole string of policies that we've seen forever, first homeowners grant, of injecting more money into demand, which is just going to drive prices up, whereas in fact the problem is with the supply. And like the problem for, at least for young people, is yes, getting on the housing ladder, but also increasingly it's about renting, not buying. And they just have nothing to say to those people at the moment. And that really goes to those teal seats that we were talking about, inner city seats where there's a lot of young people.
And look, to be fair to both the government and the opposition, many of these issues like renting are actually controlled by state governments. And it is difficult for the Commonwealth to have a role. You know, when the Greens were pushing for a rent cap, the government was saying it just doesn't work like that. You know, the Commonwealth doesn't come in and cap rents. And how are you going to actually do this? You know, the Greens have said fairly reasonably there are a whole lot of things which state and federal governments work out through COAG in a cooperative manner. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, it's easy for the Greens to come up with all kinds of elaborate policies that are never going to be implemented and make themselves look good. But, you know, that's kind of their role, is to put provocative ideas into the conversation.
So that's housing. Let's talk about nuclear. Peter Dutton says that this is a key part of their climate policy.
I think it's the only credible pathway we have to our international commitments to net zero by 2050.
Are they onto a winner, Patrick?
I don't think so, to be honest. You know, one of the big things is there's no detail about their policy out there. They're not talking about where they're going to put them, although they have said recently they're going to put them in the side of existing coal power stations. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see what people in those electorates where the existing coal power or decommissioned coal power stations are, what they think about it. What are they going to do with the waste? Where's that going to go? You know, there's none of this detail out here, which, you know, once you start talking about putting nuclear dumps in people's backyards, well, I think it's a difficult one to sell to the Australian public.
I mean, this really, in a way, like housing, but even more so on this, I think the difficulty comes for the coalition when they start to put out details, as they will have to if they're going to be serious about having this as a policy. The coalition's main spruiker for nuclear power, Ted O'Brien, has said the opposition would release its own costings on nuclear, allowing, quotes, plenty of time for a proper discussion about them before the next federal election. And you can only imagine that Labor will be jumping for joy when that happens. They're caught between a rock and a hard place, because the more detail they put out about where they want to site these things, the easier it's going to be for Labor to go to those electorates, obviously, and say, do you really want a nuclear reactor in your backyard? Mm-hmm. And if they don't put out the detail, then the Labor can say, well, as they did last year, if you're talking about small modular reactors, we're going to need 71 of those to replace existing coal-fired power stations. Whether that's true or not, it doesn't really matter. Because, you know, it's just a number that Labor can say, oh, we've got these figures that say that's how many you're going to need if you're going to be serious about this policy. And if they've got 71, that's a lot of electorates that they can talk about, where they can run a campaign saying, does the coalition want a nuclear reactor in your neighbourhood? And there's no real comeback from the coalition to that, except, oh, no, you know, it wouldn't be here. But if they don't say where they're going to be, then it's open to everyone to say, well, they might be here. It's just, I don't know. That's leaving aside all the factual, technical costs.
The cost is such a big one. Like, you know, before the 2019 and 2022 elections, for example, Labor was hammered about the cost of its energy policy. But the media's just not asking those questions about the coalition's nuclear policy. You look at the latest build of a nuclear power plant in the UK, you know, that's cost upwards of £20 billion. Like, that is a huge amount of money in a country where there is already existing nuclear power industry. You know, the cost would just be astronomical in Australia to build a nuclear industry from scratch, and it would take at least a decade, probably more like two decades, from now.
By which time the grid will have been reconfigured for renewables anyway.
Exactly.
And it also seems really at odds with their strategy to frame this around energy affordability, right? They're like, oh, this fuel efficiency standard is going to cost you this much money. But is there any detail on who's going to pay for these small modular nuclear reactors?
And look, you know, well documented, it is the most expensive form of energy. And look, the last time nuclear was looked at seriously in Australia, the only way that they found that it would be sustainable economically would be if there was a carbon price in place. And, you know, that's a whole other debate, and we've seen the history of that in Australia. So I think that's pretty unlikely to happen.
It is International Women's Day, so it would be remiss of me not to bring up the Liberal Party's woman problem. We saw them again pre-select a man in Cook. Are they ever going to fix this problem, Mike?
Well, Keith Wallahan, the Liberal MP for Menzies, which is a seat in Melbourne's eastern suburbs, which is held on a really tiny margin after the last election, like less than 1%, was on Q&A saying,
the Liberal Party's ready to pre-select talented women, but we need to lift our game in making it happen more often.
And the opposition to quotas in the party remains strong. There seems to be no suggestion that they are actually ever going to do anything about that. And probably while that continues, they're going to still have this problem. And it goes directly to the question we've been discussing about who they are trying to appeal to, because as we saw at the last election, every single Teal MP who was elected was a woman. There was a strong reaction by women in those seats. They were also more strongly against coalition policies on other things like integrity, commission and environment than men were. It's obviously should be a key part of their strategy if they want to win those seats.
Mm.
I think also it's interesting that Victoria's candidate in this was Jodie Bellier, who is a woman who's been involved in the community for many years. And Cos Maris, a Labor pollster and analyst, was talking on election night about how Labor has actually really fine-tuned its candidate selection process, and it's really paying off for them with people like Jodie Bellier. Whereas you look at in Cook, and Simon Kennedy is not a woman, and he previously ran, I think, as a candidate for Bennelong. So he wasn't particularly local either. The Liberal Party presents itself with a risk if they don't start fine-tuning or changing their pre-selection process, particularly for safe seats.
Mm.
They ran a pretty negative campaign in Dunkley, including, you know, familiar tactics around the ute tax. How did that go
the
down?
So-called UTAX, which is actually a fuel efficiency standard for new vehicles, which will save people money when you go to the fuel pump and your car will not use as much fuel to travel the same distance. But leaving that aside, it seems like the coalition's tax over this, they didn't really register. You've got to think, like, this is an outer suburban seat where people, you know, need their cars to go about their lives, drop kids at school, work, and so on. And if it can't make headway in a seat like that, is it really going to resonate across Australia? Similarly, with some of the attacks we saw on the government over the NZYQ case and the release of long-term detainees or indefinitely detained refugees and asylum seekers, it seemed to really not resonate with voters all that much. I think mainly because cost of living is like the number one issue for voters. Like, we've had 13 interest rate rises since the RBA started its monetary tightening policy. And people are really hurting over that. And it's getting to the point where basically even the Reserve Bank has acknowledged that that buffer of savings that a lot of households built up during the pandemic have completely evaporated because of the pressures of cost of living and interest rate rises. But yet, you know, instead, the opposition were talking about, you know, immigration and this so-called ute tax and failing to really make headway on the cost of living. You know, Angus Taylor has been out there a bit talking about it, but we saw Peter Dutton when he should have been in Dunkley talking about cost of living issues. Where was he? He was flying across the country to go to billionaire Gina Rinehart's, Australia's richest woman's, 70th birthday party for 40 minutes and then get on a plane and come back. You got to think about where their priorities are if they're not hammering the government over cost of living and instead talking about these two other issues. I don't know how much that fed into people, but it's definitely a perception.
Mm. I mean, throughout the whole Voice campaign, the mantra was like, why is the government wasting all this time on this woke issue when they should be talking about the cost of living? Now the government definitely is talking about the cost of living, and the coalition seem, you know, don't really have that much to say about it in terms of their own actual what their policies would be if they got back into government. Okay, fair enough. We're a year perhaps out from the next election, but this is going to be the challenge for them. The further we go on through this year, it's going to become increasingly necessary for them to spell out in more detail what their policies are. And as we've discussed on things like housing and energy, there is at the moment no clear answer to that.
Particularly because this is probably the worst it's going to get. Like, the analysts are talking about the RBA perhaps making interest rate cuts later in the year. GDP growth came in for the December quarter this week. It was 0.2, which is really weak. The economy's slowed substantially, so we might get into a situation where towards the, you know, next election, the RBA is actually cutting rates, and the impact of the reconfigured stage three tax cuts will come through. So we might be in a position where households are feeling substantially better. So the coalition's failed to capitalise on cost of living now. How are they going to do it 6 months from now or a year from now?
Next, Technicolor fish and billionaire parties.
Hey, Jane Lee here with a quick note about The Guardian. Guardian Weekly is the only place you can receive The Guardian's independent journalism in print in a magazine that gets delivered to your door. It covers global news, long reads, the environment, and more. The Guardian's offering new Australian subscribers 12 issues for $12, which is 90% off the normal price. The offer's only available until the 11th of March. So just search Guardian Weekly subscription to find out more. And for the full terms and conditions, head to theguardian.com/weekly terms. Thanks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Now we come to what we can't get out of our head. Mike, what was it for you this week?
Well, for a complete change of pace, I want to talk about the big trout in Adamantaby.
Please do talk about the big trout.
Yes, for those who consume, you know, doom scrolling and worried about the state of the world, maybe just for 30 seconds switch off and think about the big trout in Adamantaby.
And how upset people are about
it. People are very upset because it's been painted a quite bright shade of pink. Yeah, it's pretty abrupt the way it shades into, you know, people who've seen trout see how the colours sort of gradually shade from one to the other, but this one is kind of stripes.
It's
not quite Ecce Homo, the famous painting in the Spanish church where the dated by a local woman.
She did say they didn't let her finish.
But yeah, maybe it's our own tiny little mini version of that. And anyway, so I think people should go and see the big trout in Adamantaby and enjoy it for what it is.
Patrick, what can't you get out of your head?
I just have to come back to Peter Dutton heading to Perth for Gina Rinehart's birthday for 40 minutes, apparently. But there's a lot to unpack in it, partly the kind of lavish celebrations that Australia's richest woman put on for herself, including a horseback show with fantastic Aussie music, the Man from Snowy River recreation. There were multiple large cakes and onstage pyrotechnics, and Peter Dutton was there to enjoy it all. Obviously, lots of people asking questions whether that was the best look or not. In fairness, Peter Dutton said that he paid for his own flights, which are estimated to be around $5,000 or $6,000 to do all that travelling in a very short space of time. And to be fair, also the Prime Minister has come under criticism for going to another lavish celebration, this time for Anthony Pratt at his Melbourne mansion. He's a recycling billionaire who was memorably called
Redheaded Weirdo.
Redheaded Weirdo from
Australia.
Down Under. Anyway, so Anthony Albanese recently came under criticism for attending a private event, Anthony Pratt's Melbourne mansion. They had the pop star Katy Perry there, and the day after he attended Taylor Swift's Sydney concert as well, which, you know, you have to question whether that's a good look when a lot of people missed out on tickets. And, you know, I think the cheapest ones were hundreds of dollars as well. So,
but to be fair to Albo, he does go to a lot of concerts.
Yeah, but also, I don't know, is it the best look for politicians to be seen at, you know, lavish celebrations?
They could buy their own tickets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, maybe I'm wrong on this one. Thank you so much for joining us today, Patrick.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannan, Miles Herbert and Daniel Simo. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. If you liked this episode, don't forget to subscribe or follow us wherever you're listening. Full Story will be back with you on Monday. We'll see you then.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.